Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and blessings, and welcome to another installment of the Gist for Freedom of Space. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African-American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we'd love you to be a part of tonight's discussion by calling in with your comments or questions to 347-324-5552.
Section 30 of the Underground Railroad, Part 1. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Underground Railroad, Part 1, by William Still, Section 30. Barnaby Grigby, Elias John Boyer, and Mary Elizabeth, his wife. Frank Wanzer, Elias Robert Scott, Emily Foster, Elias Ann Wood. Two others who started with them were captured. All these persons journeyed together from Loudoun County, Virginia, on horseback and in a carriage for more than 100 miles, availing themselves of a holiday and their master's horses and carriage. They as deliberately started for Canada, as though they had never been taught that it was their duty as servants to obey their masters. In this particular showing a most utter disregard of the intent of their kind-hearted and indulgent owners. They left home on Monday, Christmas Eve, 1855, under the leadership of Frank Wanzer, and arrived in Columbia the following Wednesday at 1 o'clock. As witfully as they had thus made their way along, they had not found it smooth sailing by any means. The biting frost and snow rendered their travel anything but agreeable, nor did they escape the gnawings of hunger, traveling day and night, and whilst these articles were in the very act of running away, with themselves and their kind master's best horses and carriage, when about 100 miles from home, in the neighborhood of Cheat River, Maryland, they were attacked by 6 white men and a boy, who, doubtless, supposing that their intentions were of a wicked and unlawful character, felt it to be their duty and kindness to their masters, if not to the travelers, to demand of them an account of themselves. In other words, the assailants positively commanded the fugitives to show what right they possessed to be found in a condition apparently so unwarranted. The spokesman among the fugitives, affecting no ordinary amount of dignity, told their assailants plainly that no gentleman would interfere with persons riding along civilly, not allowing it to be supposed that they were slaves, of course. These gentlemen, however, were not willing to accept this account of the travelers, as their very decided steps indicated. Having the law on their side, they were for compelling the fugitives to surrender without further parley. At this juncture, the fugitives, verily believing that the time had arrived for the practical use of their pistols and dirks, pulled them out of their concealment, the young woman as well as the young men, and declared they would not be taken. One of the white men raised his gun, pointed the muzzle directly towards one of the young women, with the threat that he would shoot, etc. "Shoot, shoot, shoot," she exclaimed, with a double-barreled pistol in one hand and a long dirk knife in the other, utterly unterrified and fully ready for a death struggle. The male leader of the fugitives by this time had pulled back the hammers of his pistols and was about to fire. Their adversaries, seeing the weapons and the unflinching determination on the part of the runaways to stand their ground, spill blood, kill, or die, rather than be taken, very prudently sidled off to the other side of the road, leaving at least 4 of the victors to travel on their way. At this moment, the 4 in the carriage lost sight of the 2 on horseback. Soon after the separation, they heard firing, but what the result was, they knew not. They were fearful, however, that their companions had been captured. The following paragraph, which was shortly afterwards taken from a southern paper, leaves no room to doubt as to the fate of the 2. 6 fugitive slaves from Virginia were arrested at the Maryland line near Hood's Mill on Christmas Day, but after a severe fight, 4 of them escaped and have not since been heard of. They came from Loudoun and Fauquier counties. Though the four who were successful saw no severe fight, it is not unreasonable to suppose that there was a fight, nevertheless, but not till after the number of the fugitives had been reduced to two instead of six. As chivalrous as slaveholders and slave catchers were, they knew the value of their precious lives and the fearful risk of attempting a capture when the numbers were equal. The party in the carriage after the conflict went on their way rejoicing. The young men, one cold night, when they were compelled to take rest in the woods and snow, in vain strove to keep the feet of their female companions from freezing by lying on them, but the frost was merciless and bit them severely, as their feet very plainly showed. The following disjointed report was cut from the Frederick, Maryland, Examiner soon after the occurrence took place. Six slaves, four men and two women, fugitives from Virginia, having with them two spring wagons and four horses, came from Hood's Mill on the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, near the dividing line from Frederick and Carroll counties, on Christmas Day. After feeding their animals, one of them told a Mr. Dixon once they came. Believing them to be fugitives, he spread the alarm, and some 8 or 10 persons gathered round to arrest them. But the Negroes, drawing revolvers and bowie knives, kept their assailants at bay, until five of the party succeeded in escaping in one of the wagons, and as the last one jumped on a horse to flee, he was fired at, the load taking effect in the small of the back. The prisoner says he belongs to Charles W. Simpson, Esquire, of Fauquier County, Virginia, and ran away with the others on the preceding evening. This report from the Examiner, while it is not wholly correct, evidently relates to the fugitives above described. Why the reporter made such glaring mistakes may be accounted for on the grounds that the bold stand made by the fugitives was so bewildering and alarming that the assailants were not in proper condition to make correct statements. Nevertheless, the Examiner's report was preserved with other records and is here given for what it is worth. These victors were individually noted on the record thus. Barnaby was owned by William Rogers, a farmer, who was considered a moderate slaveholder, although of late addicted to intemperance. He was the owner of about 12 head of slaves, and had besides a wife and 2 children. Barnaby's chances for making extra change for himself were never favorable. Sometimes, of nights, he would manage to earn a trifle. He was prompted to escape because he wanted to live by the sweat of his own brow, believing that all men ought to live so. This was the only reason he gave for fleeing. Mary Elizabeth had been owned by Townsend McVee, likewise a farmer, and in Mary's judgment he was severe, but she added, his wife made him so. McVee owned about 25 slaves. He hardly allowed them to talk, would not allow them to raise chickens, and only allowed Mary 3 dresses a year. The rest she had to get as she could. Sometimes McVee would sell slaves. Last year he sold 2. Mary said that she could not say anything good of her mistress. On the contrary, she declared that her mistress knew no mercy nor showed any favor. It was on account of this domineering spirit that Mary was induced to escape. Frank was owned by Luther Sullivan, the meanest man in Virginia, he said. He treated his people just as bad as he could in every respect. Sullivan, added Frank, would lounge the slaves and stint them to save food and get rich, and would sell and whip, etc. To Frank's knowledge, he had sold some 25 head. Quote, he sold my mother and her 2 children to Georgia some 4 years previous, end quote. But the motive which hurried Frank to make his flight was his laboring under the apprehension that his master had some pretty heavy creditors who might come on him at any time. Frank, therefore, wanted to be home in Canada when these gentry should make their visit. My poor mother has been often flogged by master, said Frank. As to his mistress, he said she was tolerably good. Anne Wood was owned by McVee also, and was own sister to Elizabeth. Anne very fully sustained her sister Elizabeth's statements respecting the character of her master. The above-mentioned 4 were all young and likely. Barnaby was 26 years of age, mulatto, medium-sized, and intelligent. His wife was about 24 years of age, quite dark, good-looking, and of pleasant appearance. Frank was 25 years of age, mulatto, and very smart. Anne was 22, good-looking, and smart. After their pressing wants had been met by the Vigilance Committee, and after partial recuperation from their hard travel, etc., They were forwarded to the Vigilance Committee in New York. In Syracuse, Frank, the leader, who was engaged to Emily, concluded that the knot might as well be tied on the Underground Railroad, although penniless, as to delay the matter a single day longer. Doubtless the bravery, struggles, and trials of Emily throughout the journey had, in his estimation, added not a little to her charms. Thus, after consulting with her on the matter, her approval was soon obtained, she being too prudent and wise to refuse the hand of one who had proved himself a true friend to freedom as well as so devoted to her. The twain were accordingly made one at the Underground Railroad station in Syracuse by Superintendent Reverend J. W. Logwin. After this joyful event, they proceeded to Toronto and were there gladly received by the Ladies' Society for Aiding Colored Refugees. The following letter from Miss Agnes Willis, the wife of the distinguished Reverend Dr. Willis, brought the gratifying intelligence that these brave young adventurers fell into the hands of distinguished characters and warm friends of freedom. Toronto, 28th of January, Monday evening, 1856. Mr. Still, dear sir, I have very great pleasure in making you aware that the following respectable persons have arrived here in safety, without being annoyed in any way after you saw them. The woman, two of them, viz. Mrs. Grigsby and Mrs. Graham, have been rather ailing, but we hope they will very soon be well. They have been attended to by the Ladies' Society, and are most grateful for any attention they have received. The solitary person, Mrs. Graves, has also been attended to. Also, her box will be looked after. She is pretty well, but rather dull. However, she will get friends and feel more at home by and by. Mrs. Wanzer is quite well, and also young William Henry Sanderson. They are all of them in pretty good spirits, and I have no doubt they will succeed in whatever business they take up. In the meantime, the men are chopping wood, and the ladies are getting plenty sewing. We are always glad to see our colored refugees safe here. I remain, dear sir, yours respectfully, Agnes Willis, Treasurer to the Ladies' Society to Aid Colored Refugees. For a time, Frank enjoyed his newly won freedom and happy bride with bright prospects all around. But the thought of having left sisters and other relatives in bondage was a source of sadness in the midst of his joy. He was not long, however, in making up his mind that he would deliver them or die in the attempt. Deliberately forming his plans to go south, he resolved to take upon himself the entire responsibility for all the risks to be encountered. Not a word did he reveal to a living soul of what he was about to undertake. With $22 in cash and 3 pistols in his pocket, he started in the lightning train from Toronto for Virginia. On reaching Columbia in this state, he deemed it not safe to go any farther by public conveyance. Consequently, he commenced his long journey on foot, and as he neared the slave territory, he traveled by night altogether. For 2 weeks, night and day, he avoided trusting himself in any house, consequently was compelled to lodge in the woods. Nevertheless, during that space of time, he succeeded in delivering one of his sisters and her husband, and another friend in the bargain. You can scarcely imagine the committee's amazement on his return, as they looked upon him and listened to his noble deeds of daring and his triumph. A more brave and self-possessed man they had never seen. He knew what slavery was and the dangers surrounding him on his mission, but possessing true courage, unlike most men, he pictured no alarming difficulties in a distance of nearly 1,000 miles by the mail route, though the enemy's country, where he might have in truth said, quote, I could not pass without running the gauntlet of mobs and assassins, prisons and penitentiaries, bailiffs and constables, etc., end quote. If this hero had dwelt upon and magnified the obstacles in his way, he would most assuredly have kept off the enemy's country, and his sister and friends would have remained in chains. The following were the persons delivered by Frank Wanzer. They were his trophies, and this noble act of Frank should ever be held as a memorial and honor. The committee's brief record made on their arrival runs thus. August 18, 1856. Frank Wanzer, Robert Stewart, Elias Gasberry Robinson, Vincent Smith, Elias John Jackson, Betsy Smith, wife of Vincent Smith, Elias Fanny Jackson. They all came from Elder, Loudoun County, Virginia. Robert is about 30 years of age, medium size, dark chestnut color, intelligent and resolute. He was held by the widow Hutchinson, who was also the owner of about 100 others. Robert regarded her as a very hard mistress until the death of her husband, which took place the fall previous to his escape. That sad affliction, he thought, was the cause of a considerable change in her treatment of her slaves. But yet nothing was said about freedom on her part. This reticence Robert understood to mean that she was still unconverted on this great cardinal principle, at least. As he could see no prospect of freedom through her agency, when Frank approached him with a good report from Canada and his friends there, he could scarcely wait to listen to the glorious news. He was so willing and anxious to get out of slavery. His dear old mother, Sarah Davis, and four brothers and two sisters, William, Thomas, Frederick, and Samuel, Violet, and Ellen, were all owned by Mrs. Hutchinson. Dear as they were to him, he saw no way to take them with him, nor was he prepared to remain a day longer under the yoke, so he decided to accompany Frank, let the cost be what it might. Vincent is about 23 years of age, very likely looking, dark color, and more than ordinarily intelligent for one having only the common chances of slaves. He was owned by the estate of Nathan Skinner, who was looked upon, by those who knew him, as a good slaveholder. In slave property, however, he was only interested to the number of 12 head. Skinner neither sold nor emancipated. A year and a half before Vincent escaped, his master was called to give an account of his stewardship, and there in the spirit land, Vincent was willing to let him remain without much more to add about him. Vincent left his mother, Judith Smith, and brothers and sisters, Edwin, Angeline, Sina Ann, Adeline Susan, George, John, and Louis, all belonging to the estate of Skinner. Vincent was fortunate enough to bring his wife along with him. She was about 27 years of age, of a brown color, and smart, and was owned by the daughter of the widow Hutchinson. This mistress was said to be a clever woman. End of section 30.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, and blessings, and welcome to another installment of the Gist for Freedom Estate. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African-American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we'd love you to be a part of tonight's discussion by calling in with your comments or questions to 347-324-5552.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Preston Washington. I'm your host here on the Gist of Freedom, coming to you from www.blackhistoryblog.com. You can also pick us up on www.blackhistoryuniversity.com. Tonight we're going to continue to listen to an excerpt from William Steele's book, The Underground Railroad. And what we're listening to tonight is called A Bold Strike for Freedom. Joining me is my guest, Eric Estep. Are you there, Eric?
Yes, actually it's English. It's pronounced Estep, but it's a common mistake.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, Estep, yes, long E, sorry. But most of the time it's pronounced Estep.
Okay. Well, tell our listeners a little bit about you, Eric.
Well, sure. I think the first thing they need to know is that I'm wearing a Cubs shirt and I live in St. Louis. So I'm an associate professor at Southern Illinois University Edwardsville, about 15 miles east of St. Louis. I've been here a couple years. We're the Cougars. I'd like to just dedicate this show to my father, David Andes Estep, who died 3.5 years ago in Edenton, North Carolina. He was a great guy, and wherever he's at, you know, I love you, Dad, and I miss you. In terms of my scholarship, the last book I published is The Generation X Librarian, along with Martin Wallace and Rebecca Tully Stokes. It was published in 2011 by McFarland Press. I have an upcoming book by Library Juice Press with Nathaniel Enright called Class in Librarianship that should be out in the fall. coming up, I'll be at ALA in less than 2 weeks moderating a panel up in Chicago at McCormick Place. Recently published an article in 3% Press on David Foster Wallace. It was a semi-ode to David Foster Wallace. It was published in April. Pretty proud of that writing. I have a lot of other projects. I'm the book review editor of Progressive Librarian. And that's just kind of the Cliff Notes version. Always been in love with history. I was born in Kingsport, Tennessee, and I've been a history fanatic ever since then. And I'm honored to be on your show. I hope I can do as well as the other guests.
Well, I'm sure you will. Now, you said you had a book out already?
Yes, sir. It's called The Generation X Librarian. It was co-edited with Martin Wallace, who's at the University of Maine, Rebecca Tully Stokes, who's at East Tennessee State, which is where my father went, in Johnson City, close to where I was born, and I was the third co-editor. And it was published in May of 2011, and it's kind of an interesting book. Obviously, I'm a biased source, but we had a collection of essays from a variety of perspectives, and it was very, multicultural from all kinds of perspectives, class. It's a veritable potpourri, and I think it's an excellent book. It's been out for a couple of years. McFarland Press is in Western North Carolina. They'll have a booth up at ALA, and I encourage people to purchase the book. You can go to McFarland's website, and it's an e-book format now. It's been out for a couple of years, and I think it deserves wider circulation because, we've been talking about generations for a long time, and, tonight we're talking about it's a story about generations.
Okay, where is that book available from?
McFarland Press. If you go to the McFarland Press website, you can get it. Also, it's on Amazon.com. Basically, any place online. It's a book that's not available, I don't think, in the bookstores. I think it's about $50 now, but don't quote me on that. It's been out for a while. I think it's an excellent book, but I'm biased.
Okay. I want to say to our producer, ask her if she can see me. And okay, don't know when we'll be starting with our reading of the or listening to.
Oh, that's okay. It's a nice balmy Sunday night, so it's pleasant.
Yes. Are you familiar with William Still's work?
I'm sorry.
Are you familiar with William Still's work, this particular book?
Oh, yes, yes. I was reading it all week. I mean, I think it's – I was at Swarthmore College in 2006, and I was able to, go into the archives there, and I'm very much familiar with the Underground Railroad and that story, and I think it's fascinating. I think it points to where we're going in our country. History is eternal, and, I'm one of those people, I'm an optimist about this country. And I think something like, the Underground Railroad and the way, starting up in Pennsylvania, because we all know about Harriet Tubman. And I think that just those stories need to be told because that brings our country together. And I feel very strongly about that. And I think that as long as we have these conversations, I think it's important. That's what democracy is all about, is talking. And I think I was cheered to see it in the Atlantic.
Yes. Can you give our – we're going to introduce the clip.
Sure.
And go from that, and I'll be taking notes. And if anyone wants to join us, feel free to do so. And the clip will be starting here shortly, probably cutting me off, but that's okay.
Okay, great.
And the clip we're listening to again is from William Still's book, The Underground Railroad, Bold Strike for Freedom.
Section 30 of The Underground Railroad, Part 1. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Underground Railroad, Part 1, by William Still. Section 30. Barnaby Grigby, Elias John Boyer, and Mary Elizabeth, his wife. Frank Wanzer, Elias Robert Scott, Emily Foster, Elias Ann Wood. Two others who started with them were captured. All these persons journeyed together from Loudoun County, Virginia, on horseback and in a carriage for more than 100 miles. Availing themselves of a holiday and their master's horses and carriage, they as deliberately started for Canada as though they had never been taught that it was their duty as servants to obey their masters. In this particular showing, a most utter disregard of the intent of their kind-hearted and indulgent owners. They left home on Monday, Christmas Eve, 1855, under the leadership of Frank Wanzer, and arrived in Columbia the following Wednesday at 1 o'clock. As witfully as they had thus made their way along, they had not found it smooth sailing by any means. The biting frost and snow rendered their travel anything but agreeable. Nor did they escape the gnawings of hunger, traveling day and night, and whilst these articles were in the very act of running away with themselves and their kind master's best horses and carriage, when about 100 miles from home, in the neighborhood of Cheat River, Maryland, they were attacked by 6 white men and a boy, who, doubtless, supposing that their intentions were of a wicked and unlawful character, felt it to be their duty and kindness to their masters, if not to the travelers, to demand of them an account of themselves. In other words, the assailants positively commanded the fugitives to show what right they possessed to be found in a condition apparently so unwarranted. The spokesman among the fugitives, affecting no ordinary amount of dignity, told their assailants plainly that no gentleman would interfere with persons riding along civilly, not allowing it to be supposed that they were slaves, of course. These gentlemen, however, were not willing to accept this account of the travelers, as their very decided steps indicated. Having the law on their side, they were for compelling the fugitives to surrender without further parley. At this juncture, the fugitives, verily believing that the time had arrived for the practical use of their pistols and dirks, pulled them out of their concealment, the young woman as well as the young men, and declared they would not be taken. One of the white men raised his gun, pointed the muzzle directly towards one of the young women, with the threat that he would shoot, etc. "Shoot, shoot, shoot," she exclaimed, with a double-barreled pistol in one hand and a long dirk knife in the other, utterly unterrified and fully ready for a death struggle. The male leader of the fugitives by this time had pulled back the hammers of his pistols and was about to fire. Their adversaries, seeing the weapons and the unflinching determination on the part of the runaways to stand their ground, spill blood, kill, or die, rather than be taken, very prudently sidled off to the other side of the road, leaving at least 4 of the victors to travel on their way. At this moment, the 4 in the carriage lost sight of the 2 on horseback. Soon after the separation, they heard firing, but what the result was, they knew not. They were fearful, however, that their companions had been captured. The following paragraph, which was shortly afterwards taken from a southern paper, leaves no room to doubt as to the fate of the 2. 6 fugitive slaves from Virginia were arrested at the Maryland line near Hood's Mill on Christmas Day, but after a severe fight, 4 of them escaped and have not since been heard of. They came from Loudoun and Fauquier counties. Though the 4 who were successful saw no severe fight, it is not unreasonable to suppose that there was a fight, nevertheless, but not till after the number of the fugitives had been reduced to 2 instead of 6. As chivalrous as slaveholders and slave catchers were, they knew the value of their precious lives and the fearful risk of attempting a capture when the numbers were equal. The party in the carriage after the conflict went on their way rejoicing. The young men, one cold night, when they were compelled to take rest in the woods and snow, in vain strove to keep the feet of their female companions from freezing by lying on them, but the frost was merciless and bit them severely, as their feet very plainly showed. The following disjointed report was cut from the Frederick, Maryland, Examiner soon after the occurrence took place. 6 slaves, 4 men and 2 women, fugitives from Virginia, having with them 2 spring wagons and 4 horses, came from Hood's Mill on the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, near the dividing line from Frederick and Carroll counties, on Christmas Day. After feeding their animals, one of them told a Mr. Dixon once they came. Believing them to be fugitives, he spread the alarm, and some 8 or 10 persons gathered round to arrest them. but the Negroes, drawing revolvers and bowie knives, kept their assailants at bay until five of the party succeeded in escaping in one of the wagons, and as the last one jumped on a horse to flee, he was fired at, the load taking effect in the small of the back. The prisoner says he belongs to Charles W. Simpson, Esquire, of Fauquier County, Virginia, and ran away with the others on the preceding evening. This report from the Examiner, while it is not wholly correct, evidently relates to the fugitives above described. Why the reporter made such glaring mistakes may be accounted for on the grounds that the bold stand made by the fugitives was so bewildering and alarming that the assailants were not in proper condition to make correct statements. Nevertheless, the Examiner's report was preserved with other records and is here given for what it is worth. These victors were individually noted on the record thus. Barnaby was owned by William Rogers, a farmer, who was considered a moderate slaveholder, although of late addicted to intemperance. He was the owner of about one dozen head of slaves, and had besides a wife and two children. Barnaby's chances for making extra change for himself were never favorable. Sometimes, of nights, he would manage to earn a trifle. He was prompted to escape because he wanted to live by the sweat of his own brow, believing that all men ought to live so. This was the only reason he gave for fleeing. Mary Elizabeth had been owned by Townsend McVee, likewise a farmer, and in Mary's judgment he was severe, but she added, his wife made him so. McVee owned about 25 slaves. He hardly allowed them to talk, would not allow them to raise chickens, and only allowed Mary 3 dresses a year. The rest she had to get as she could. Sometimes McVee would sell slaves. Last year he sold 2. Mary said that she could not say anything good of her mistress. On the contrary, she declared that her mistress knew no mercy nor showed any favor. It was on account of this domineering spirit that Mary was induced to escape. Frank was owned by Luther Sullivan, the meanest man in Virginia, he said. He treated his people just as bad as he could in every respect. Sullivan, added Frank, would lounge the slaves and stint them to save food and get rich, and would sell and whip, etc. To Frank's knowledge, he had sold some 25 head. Quote, he sold my mother and her 2 children to Georgia some 4 years previous, end quote. But the motive which hurried Frank to make his flight was his laboring under the apprehension that his master had some pretty heavy creditors who might come on him at any time. Frank, therefore, wanted to be home in Canada when these gentry should make their visit. My poor mother has been often flogged by master, said Frank. As to his mistress, he said she was tolerably good. Anne Wood was owned by McVee also, and was own sister to Elizabeth. Anne very fully sustained her sister Elizabeth's statements respecting the character of her master. The above-mentioned 4 were all young and likely. Barnaby was 26 years of age, mulatto, medium-sized, and intelligent. His wife was about 24 years of age, quite dark, good-looking, and of pleasant appearance. Frank was 25 years of age, mulatto, and very smart. Anne was 22, good-looking, and smart. After their pressing wants had been met by the Vigilance Committee, and after partial recuperation from their hard travel, etc., they were forwarded to the Vigilance Committee in New York. In Syracuse, Frank, the leader, who was engaged to Emily, concluded that the knot might as well be tied on the Underground Railroad, although penniless, as to delay the matter a single day longer. Doubtless the bravery, struggles, and trials of Emily throughout the journey had, in his estimation, added not a little to her charms. Thus, after consulting with her on the matter, her approval was soon obtained, she being too prudent and wise to refuse the hand of one who had proved himself a true friend to freedom as well as so devoted to her. The twain were accordingly made one at the Underground Railroad station in Syracuse by Superintendent Reverend J. W. Logwin. After this joyful event, they proceeded to Toronto and were there gladly received by the Ladies' Society for Aiding Colored Refugees. The following letter from Miss Agnes Willis, the wife of the distinguished Reverend Dr. Willis, brought the gratifying intelligence that these brave young adventurers fell into the hands of distinguished characters and warm friends of freedom. Toronto, 28th of January, Monday evening, 1856. Mr. Still, dear sir, I have very great pleasure in making you aware that the following respectable persons have arrived here in safety without being annoyed in any way after you saw them. The woman, two of them, viz., Mrs. Grigsby and Mrs. Graham, have been rather ailing, but we hope they will very soon be well. They have been attended to by the Ladies' Society and are most grateful for any attention they have received. The solitary person, Mrs. Graves, has also been attended to. Also, her box will be looked after. She is pretty well, but rather dull. However, she will get friends and feel more at home by and by. Mrs. Wanzer is quite well, and also young William Henry Sanderson. They are all of them in pretty good spirits, and I have no doubt they will succeed in whatever business they take up. In the meantime, the men are chopping wood, and the ladies are getting plenty sewing. We are always glad to see our colored refugees safe here. I remain, dear sir, yours respectfully, Agnes Willis, Treasurer to the Ladies' Society to Aid Colored Refugees. For a time, Frank enjoyed his newly won freedom and happy bride, with bright prospects all around. But the thought of having left sisters and other relatives in bondage was a source of sadness in the midst of his joy. He was not long, however, in making up his mind that he would deliver them or die in the attempt. Deliberately forming his plans to go south, he resolved to take upon himself the entire responsibility for all the risks to be encountered. Not a word did he reveal to a living soul of what he was about to undertake. With $22 in cash and 3 pistols in his pocket, he started in the lightning train from Toronto for Virginia. On reaching Columbia in this state, he deemed it not safe to go any farther by public conveyance. Consequently, he commenced his long journey on foot, and as he neared the slave territory, he traveled by night altogether. For 2 weeks, night and day, he avoided trusting himself in any house, consequently was compelled to lodge in the woods. Nevertheless, during that space of time, he succeeded in delivering one of his sisters and her husband, and another friend in the bargain. You can scarcely imagine the committee's amazement on his return, as they looked upon him and listened to his noble deeds of daring and his triumph. A more brave and self-possessed man they had never seen. He knew what slavery was and the dangers surrounding him on his mission, but possessing true courage, unlike most men, he pictured no alarming difficulties in a distance of nearly 1,000 miles by the mail route, though the enemy's country, where he might have in truth said, quote, "I could not pass without running the gauntlet of mobs and assassins, prisons and penitentiaries, bailiffs and constables, etc." End quote. If this hero had dwelt upon and magnified the obstacles in his way, he would most assuredly have kept off the enemy's country, and his sister and friends would have remained in chains. The following were the persons delivered by Frank Wanzer. They were his trophies, and this noble act of Frank should ever be held as a memorial and honor. The committee's brief record made on their arrival runs thus. August 18, 1856. Frank Wanzer, Robert Stewart, Elias Gasberry Robinson, Vincent Smith, alias John Jackson, Betsy Smith, wife of Vincent Smith, alias Fanny Jackson. They all came from Alder, Loudoun County, Virginia. Robert is about 30 years of age, medium size, dark chestnut color, intelligent and resolute. He was held by the widow Hutchinson, who was also the owner of about 100 others. Robert regarded her as a very hard mistress until the death of her husband, which took place the fall previous to his escape. That sad affliction, he thought, was the cause of a considerable change in her treatment of her slaves. But yet nothing was said about freedom on her part. This reticence Robert understood to mean that she was still unconverted on this great cardinal principle, at least. As he could see no prospect of freedom through her agency, when Frank approached him with a good report from Canada and his friends there, he could scarcely wait to listen to the glorious news. He was so willing and anxious to get out of slavery. His dear old mother, Sarah Davis, and 4 brothers and 2 sisters, William, Thomas, Frederick, and Samuel, Violet, and Ellen, were all owned by Mrs. Hutchinson. Dear as they were to him, he saw no way to take them with him, nor was he prepared to remain a day longer under the yoke, so he decided to accompany Frank, let the cost be what it might. Vincent is about 23 years of age, very likely looking, dark color, and more than ordinarily intelligent for one having only the common chances of slaves. He was owned by the estate of Nathan Skinner, who was looked upon, by those who knew him, as a good slaveholder. Enslaved property, however, he was only interested to the number of 12 head. Skinner neither sold nor emancipated. A year and a half before Vincent escaped, his master was called to give an account of his stewardship, and there in the spirit land, Vincent was willing to let him remain without much more to add about him. Vincent left his mother, Judith Smith, and brothers and sisters, Edwin, Angeline, Sina Ann, Adeline Susan, George, John, and Louis, all belonging to the estate of Skinner. Vincent was fortunate enough to bring his wife along with him. She was about 27 years of age, of a brown color, and smart, and was owned by the daughter of the widow Hutchinson. This mistress was said to be a clever woman. End of section 30.
Okay, so...
Yeah,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I would just like to comment on that, kind of within context, if I may. Before coming to SIUE, I was the publisher of the North Carolina Periodicals Index. And I don't want it to sound like an Oscars acceptance speech, but I would like to highlight some really great historical resources. And East Carolina, especially, well, both Laupitz and Junior Library, but the special collections there is a treasure for African-American or Southern history or any kind of history. Mari Yark is the head of special collections. There's a Southern gentleman of the highest order, and it's really a testament. That collection's fantastic. John Lawrence, Jan Lewis, Barry Munson, too many people really to mention. You know, grad assistants like Dean Marshall Tuck and Elizabeth Howland, Matt Reynolds, who did a fantastic job of organizing the North Carolina, or supervising the students. I mean, and William O'Neill, who's there. It's really a fantastic resource. I encourage people, if they find that audio, which is fantastic, you know, it's free. I mean, that's what librarians do. We're kind of the Ringo Starrs of the academic world, you know. We support people. I encourage people to look at that collection. It's a rich resource. You can find it online pretty easily. Unfortunately, I can't remember the URL, but the North Carolina Periodicals Index, the NCPI, is just a tremendous resource. And people like North Carolina Periodicals Index.
North Carolina Periodical Index, okay.
Now, that's at East Carolina University. There's also a special collection in Chapel Hill, but I would like to focus on Eastern Carolina, because there's a rich history there, too.
Okay, great.
In terms of what we just heard, I think it's a great example of kind of globalization. You know, you had the Underground Railroad, you had Canada, which was free, you know, under English rule, and you had people moving up and down the coast. Or not the coast, I'm sorry, but I think you understand what I'm saying, up and down North America. When we think of globalization, that's kind of one of the buzzwords today. But globalization has been with us everywhere. And I think a narrative like that kind of brings history to fore. I mean, I have tremendous students I've had tremendous students, still have tremendous students, but many of them, you know, think that the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor. And I think it's probably relies too much on Wikipedia. And a reading like this, which is free, and a podcast like this, gives history, it's living history. I think the still narrative is very important because it's hidden history. You know?
Exactly.
I mean, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I think it's when we opened up the show, you made a comment about how the narrative was really comparative to what's going on today. And sure enough, I heard in the clip, stand your ground. This kind of reminded me of the case that's going on down there in Florida right now.
It does. And I think it's important to put these things in context because I had a professor, James Farr, at Purdue University, and he told us one time that, you know, we're like zombies walking around if we don't know our history. And, you know, what's going on in Brevard County, I believe it's Brevard County, I think that I think we need to take a deep breath and look at the history of our country. You know, that's a hot-button issue, but if you take a look at the context of history, it doesn't need to be.
Exactly.
And I think that we need to take a deep breath, collectively, look at it analytically, and keep our powder dry, because these are tense times. And I think we need to put things into perspective. So many young people today, they don't have perspective. They look on Facebook and they think they want to be famous. You know, the third book I'm working on is a political thought of Christopher Lash, and the working title is "You're So Vain, You Think This Book Is About You." Don't have a publisher yet, so if anyone wants to publish it, I'd be happy to listen to offers. And I think there's a real narcissism in our culture, and that's because we don't know our history. We think we're the first people to found things, or we're the first people to suffer. And, you know, part of life is suffering, and I think we need to put this into context. You know, that's what history does, because if you look at it, today's Father's Day, right? But there was a, you know, I mean, we've been honoring our fathers for thousands of years, and we just don't have that context. And that's why this podcast is so valuable, you know, and it kind of, it's not spoon-feeding to listen to something online, because it's providing a different outlet. That's what we do as librarians. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why this podcast is so important. Because this is something I wasn't that familiar with until I read the article in The Atlantic.
I see. You mentioned young people, and one thing I would want them to be aware of are the newspaper accounts. We heard in the reading that there were a number of newspaper accounts relative to that escape of those. I think it started out as 6 and wound up being 4.
Something like that. That sounds about right. I think,
yeah.
And again, you know, those newspaper accounts are amazing. You know, at Southern Illinois, Edwardsville, where I'm at now, we have the historical New York Times, and that's just a big paper. And I always tell students, you know, look at the record. Look at the, you know, New York Times is the paper record, it's mainstream, but, you know, look at smaller newspapers. Imagine yourself going back in time. We had in 2011, we had a kind of a, I guess you'd call it like a fair for students. It was kind of a, my department head, Lydia Jackson, who was just named full head this year during Black History Month, she had the idea of having a kind of like a fair. And what we did is, it's online, too. You can go online and look at these things. If you go to Lovejoy Library, all these things are online. And what we had the students do is we had the students pick a date looking at the historical New York Times. And so what that did, which I think is great, is that, you know, maybe their birthday, you know, I mean, I was born, I hate to say it, September 3rd, 1970, and I'm getting kind of old. But, you know, those students going back, say, you know, to 1981, 1985, it puts their own history into context.
Yeah, earlier you mentioned Swarthmore College. Could you let our listeners explain to our listeners why that college in Pennsylvania was important to the Underground Railroad?
Yes. My old friend Ed Fuller, who passed away last fall, he's a long-time librarian there. We talked about that a lot, as well with Ann Garrison, who's still there, the literature librarian. And it's a Quaker school. John Densmore is the archivist there. And the Quakers were key in freeing the slaves. They provided the moral ballast. You know, they didn't provide the bullets because they're Quakers. And let's not forget Richard Nixon was a Quaker, so, you know, history's complicated. But they provided the moral ballast, the moral arguments to end slavery. And I think that, you know, it was a haven. Swarthmore was a haven for free thought and for abolitionist thinking. You know, it's one of the best colleges in the country, but people don't realize the roots of Swarthmore. A lot of people think, well, you know, that's where Michael Dukakis went, but it goes back farther than that.
They were key.
They provided kind of the connective tissue of the Underground Railroad. I mean, Philadelphia is such an interesting city itself. You know, many people say it's the northernmost southern city or the southernmost northern city, but it's kind of one of those linchpins on the road to freedom.
Yeah, this arsenal, it sounds like a John Brown kind of move there in terms of the arsenal. These escapees seem to be heavily armed, not only with, what if the one lady had a double-barreled pistol and a knife?
Right, and I mean, I think at Harper's Ferry, Brown had pikes, is what I want to say, in Harper's Ferry, Virginia at the time. I mean, and that's the real tension. You know, John Brown is kind of one of those third rail figures in American history because he was a revolutionary. Many people think he was a revolutionary. He was a man ahead of his time. I mean, they sang, the Union soldiers sang John Brown's body, as you know. I mean, I'm not talking to our listeners. Sang, you know, John Brown's body, Marching in Gray, so I can't quite get the words right. And, you know, Brown was the guy. I mean, I believe it was 1859, I want to say, the Harper's Raid. And, you know, I mean, he was a guy that was ahead of his time. But, you know, in the South, that's a controversial still to this day. And then if you want to go farther south from Brown, you have the Slave Rebellion in Southern Virginia. Fires of Jubilee.
The minister.
No, it was a black slave who led a revolt in the 1830s. And who wrote a book about that? Stephen Oates wrote a book about it. It was the Fires of Jubilee. But that was kind of an incendiary thing, too. So Nathaniel Scott? It escapes me right now. But it's all connected together, you know. Because, I mean, if you look at John Brown, I mean, Brown was an iconic figure of the time. I mean, I live in, close to St. Louis, and Kansas isn't far away from us. You know, bloody Kansas. I work at a library named after an abolitionist, Lovejoy. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, it was Nat Turner.
Nat Turner, I'm sorry. I'm so tired.
There in Virginia in the early 1830s.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's who it was.
Nat Turner, I'm sorry, in St. Louis, so, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, that kind of connective tissue, it's important to know this, because context is vital, you know, it's vital. And I think that narrative, you know, it's something that we need to keep hammering home, because if we don't understand our history, what's happening, that trial happening in Brevard County, I think that we'll get too excited about it, you know. The United States has always been a multi-ethnic democracy, however you want to cut it. I mean, slavery was our founding sin. But within our Constitution, there's always a way for people to get along. And I don't think people realize that. You know, I have people talking about how horrible things are today. They don't realize that we had an election during our Civil War in 1864. I don't know too many Civil Wars where they actually had Democratic elections. So things have been... I'm sorry, go ahead. I'm sorry, sir.
You mentioned Bleeding Kansas. Is that what got John Brown involved?
I think so. I mean, there's a lot of good books on that. Russell Banks wrote a good novel called, I want to say, Dreamcatcher. I can't recall right now. And there's been a lot of literature on Brown. I think John Brown was a guy who believed in the cause. He was a true believer. You could almost say he was the Che Guevara of his times. I know that's being anachronistic. I think Kansas inflamed a lot of people because it was a border state. You know, you had the 1850 Compromise, and I think that if you think of the United States as moving west, the states in the middle, those are always going to be hot. I mean, there's a civil war within a civil war. I mean, that was like a pre-civil war there. I mean, Brown, you know, executed slaveholders executed abolitionists. I mean, the library I work at now was named after an abolitionist who was murdered. He was thrown into the Mississippi River. His press was destroyed. When I walk to work, I see a portrait of Abraham Lincoln. So, you know, especially living in kind of a border state, border region, you know, the history is right in front of you. I mean, Faulkner has that great quote, you know, that I'm going to butcher it because I'm live, but history isn't even past. My apologies to William Faulkner. But, you know, so I think that Brown was a guy, he was a true believer. And he was willing to do what it takes, but at the same time, you know, his rebellion didn't work. Frederick Douglass had a chance to join him. He didn't do it, you know, to Frederick Douglass's acumen and credit. And I think Brown even thought that he wouldn't win. I mean, he armed his troops with pikes. Robert E. Lee and Jeb Stuart came in with the Marines and fairly quickly snuffed it out. And I think, I can't remember what Brown said when they hung him, but I think most intelligent people knew that a storm was coming. And I think Brown was sort of a prophet for that storm.
Yeah, and Brown was actually, when all that border war started there in Kansas, that Bleeding Kansas that you mentioned, and he was actually freeing and defending whites because whites started killing whites.
That's right. Because... There's a situation that they're fighting over free labor. I mean, there's Eric Foner wrote a great book called Free Soil, Free Labor, I think Free People. I'm butchering it. I don't have it in front of me. But that was about the founding of the Republican Party and really the fight in Kansas. Also, a great historian, Steve Hansen, wrote a book about the Republican Party in Illinois. And I think that really it was about, you know, should it be free labor or slave labor? You know, I mean, most of us, have seen the Spielberg's Lincoln, which was fantastic. And that was a conversation really about, you know.
Did you mention that the film of Lincoln was fantastic? Is that what, did I miss that?
Well, I said most people thought it was fantastic.
What did you think?
I'm going to hedge my bets. I'm going to hedge my bets on that.
Okay.
I'll give you my perspective. I think Spielberg is hit or miss. I think there's a lot of schmaltz with Spielberg. I think, and I've been to the Lincoln Museum in Springfield. It was marvelous. I went with my friend Chad Call. And I think that, Daniel Day-Lewis nailed the performance. However, it was based on a really bad book by Doris Kearns Goodwin, who's a plagiarist. And I thought it was appalling that Hollywood would use a plagiarist.
Was that the book, The Team of Rivals?
Right. She's a plagiarist. I mean, she didn't plagiarize that, but she plagiarized previous books. So they took a hack historian's book, which any person can, you know, reading their morning table, it's kind of a mediocre book. But what I think really centered the movie, which I think it is a good movie, and I'm aware of the controversy, is that Daniel Day-Lewis's performance centered that. Now, of course, did they get things wrong about emancipation? They did. They did, because the slaves freed themselves. But it was also teamwork, and I think Spielberg was right to telescope that into a certain time, because The Team of Rivals was about the 4 years. Speaking of Kansas, Thomas Frank had a good piece in Harper's. He was very critical of the book, or of the movie, about how basically it's just a corporate, because you see that corporate ideology, let's just get a team of rivals, you know, corporate consultants, and he critiqued the movie on that basis. However, you know, I'm a centrist, a centrist whole. I think Spielberg got the gist of it. You know, he got the spirit of Lincoln, and it's called Lincoln. So I think it is a good movie. I do think that the criticisms are valid, but it's also just a movie. So
yeah.
I'm hedging my
bet. Repeat that again for our listeners about what the slaves did in terms of...
Well, they emancipated themselves. People don't realize that they emancipated themselves. The Union Army was composed I don't have the numbers in front of me, but they don't realize the bravery of the black troops and also the white officers. There was a massacre in Fort Pillow, which is about three or four hours south of here. Don't quote me on this, but Nathan Bedford Forrest, you know, Confederates, generally speaking, wouldn't take black Union troops prisoner. And what they would do is they would massacre them on the field of battle and also execute the Union officers. And people don't realize that. At all, and the Union Army became a war of when January 1st, 1863 happened. The Union Army became an army of liberation. Everywhere they went, and slaves were going into their lines, freeing themselves. So really, it was self emancipation. But you needed the bayonets of the Union Army too. I mean, the Quakers, great, you know, peace, love, and forgiveness. I believe in peace. I'm a pacifist myself, but you also needed bayonets to win that war, and it was, in many cases, it was black bayonets.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point you brought out, in that blacks freed themselves after facing one of the worst forms of slavery on earth. You know, you were
born
into slavery.
And what's interesting is that the Confederacy in its dying days also armed their slaves. In March of 1865, Judah Benjamin went to England and France and said, "We'll free our slaves if you recognize us." It's far too little, far too late. So there were black Confederate troops marching in Richmond. And mostly that was just the South was running out of men. I mean, I'm not an expert on that era. So basically, black soldiers were fighting on both sides. Which is astonishing if you think about it. But
the majority were fighting for the Union.
Oh, vast majority, 95%, 99%. And this was a desperate measure. Let me be clear. This was at the near the end of the Civil War. This was March of 1865. I mean, Appomattox was just a month away. And they marched a regiment in Richmond. So this was the Confederacy playing its last card. They were forced into it. There's a very good book about, it's called Union in Peril. I think written by a guy by the name of Charles Jones, University of North Carolina Press, came out like in 1990, which kind of highlights that, because the key to the Confederate strategy was to get Britain and France to formally recognize them, and they would do anything for that. So if they free their slaves, then they take the odious stain of slavery off the table. But by March 1865, the Confederacy was losing badly. So it's a very pragmatic measure. And it would never have happened had there not been the Emancipation Proclamation. So it's important to get these things in order. But yeah, the vast majority were fought for their freedom. And then, of course, they were coerced into fighting for the Confederate Army. I think they were maybe given the opportunity for their freedom. In Louisiana, there were Creoles fighting for the Confederacy, and Stan Waite in the West, Native American, had slaves fighting for the Confederacy. So, you know, the Civil War is complicated.
Stan Waite was the a Cherokee general.
That's right, for the Confederacy.
Yeah, the highest ranking Native American in the Civil War.
And I believe it was the Oklahoma Territory at the time, or maybe Arkansas, I can't remember.
Oh, it was Indian Territory at the time.
Indian Territory at the time, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and the Cherokee Nation was in the northeast part of what we now know as Oklahoma.
Correct, thank you, I appreciate that.
I want to remind our listeners that the statue of Frederick Douglass is going to be unveiled at the U.S. Capitol.
Ooh, that's great.
On Juneteenth Day, which is the 19th of June.
Yes, Juneteenth, Ralph Ellison. Yeah, yes, sir.
At 11 a.m. So for those
that was the Battle of Brownsville. That was the last battle of the Civil War. Yeah, Ralph Ellison's second novel, posthumous, Juneteenth, which is brilliant. Yes, sir. So that's great. I did not know Frederick Douglass, a statue. Finally.
Yeah.
Finally.
I thought he would have been up before Martin Luther King. But in any event, we've got to start wrapping this up.
Okay.
Do you have any, now, you mentioned some books. Do you have any engagements coming up? Or
I do. I do have the one, yes. I will be a moderator of a panel at the American Library Association Conference in Chicago. It's the Law and Political Science section. My friends at LPSS, Lee LaFleur, I'm sorry.
What are the dates?
The dates, it's June, 2 weeks from now, but it's Saturday. And I believe it's at 1:30. It's the McCormick Place. You have to register for the conference. It's the American Library Association Conference. I believe it's the second biggest book conference in the world. And it's 2 weeks from this weekend. I don't know what the prices are to register, but if you register, you can come in and hear me moderate a panel. It's the Law and Political Science section, LPSS. I want to say it's at 1:30 Saturday. And what's today's date, sir? I'm sorry. I'm a little tired. Today's the 16th, right? So it would be June 29th.
Okay, great. And contact information, if our listeners want to get a hold of you, how would they do that?
Sure. It's actually the late Eric Hobsbawm. It's HOBSBAWM17@gmail.com.
Okay.
Best way to reach me.
Can they contact you on Facebook?
Yes, they can, and I'll be happy to speak at any engagement. I'm a publicity whore, so.
Okay.
Be happy to do it. If you want me for your bar mitzvah, it might cost a little more, but apart from that, I'd be happy to talk history, you know. So please feel free to contact me. I have quite a bit of time available these days.
Okay, great. Eric, I really appreciate your joining us under such short notice.
I'm honored.
For our listeners, my guest tonight has been Eric Estep.
Yes, sir. Longy.
And we've been talking history here, abolitionist-type history. Also listened to an excerpt from William Steele's book, The Underground Railroad, The Bold Strike for Freedom. And you've been listening to The Gist of Freedom, that's G-I-S-T, of Freedom. Our producer is Leslie Gist, and if you want to contact Leslie, you can do that at leslie@thegistoffreedom.com.
KansasCityMissouri.com. My name is Preston Washington. I've been your host here in Kansas City, Missouri. Good night, everybody.
Yes, thank you. Let's do this again.
Okay, take care.
Thank you, sir.
All right.
It was an honor.